want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you from San Francisco. And our program is supported by great listeners, including Gail, you know who you are, Don Sisney, Deborah Hoover, and all the way on the Big Island of Hawaii, Russ Howley Archibald. Thank you for supporting our program. And if you're financially able and so inclined, just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side are easy links where you can pick a subscription for as low as $5 a month, and it's all voluntary. In today's podcast, two views of the president's shuffle of the cabinet-level posts related to national security. In our second segment, we'll be joined by Jonathan Stevenson, a professor of strategic studies at the U.S. Naval War College. He has an essay in the new issue of Harper's Magazine called Owned by the Army, subtitled, Has the President Lost Control of His Generals? And right at the end of the podcast today, Will Durst weighs in with one of his commentaries. This one is about the birthers and the production of the long-form birth certificate this week. And to lead our program, Ray McGovern returns to the Peter B. Collins Show, a longtime contributor, and he served our nation for more than 27 years as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency and an Army intelligence officer. And he works with Tell the Word now, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, and he writes frequently about important issues. Ray, welcome back to the show today.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
Well, I always appreciate your insight because you've been there, you've been briefed in black ops, and you've briefed the president on a daily basis about national security issues. And I wanted to get your thoughts about the musical chairs. This didn't come as a surprise. It was leaked as a trial balloon a few weeks ago. And just this week, the president announced that Leon Panetta is leaving the CIA to run the Pentagon, and David Petraeus is leaving the job running the war in Afghanistan to run the Central Intelligence Agency. Not only that, old hands like Ryan Crocker, the former ambassador to Pakistan and under Bush ambassador to Baghdad, will be rejoining the government to be ambassador to Kabul. And these are the old boys just shuffled into new jobs, Ray. And I'm not very excited about this shuffle. I don't see any real positive change in policy, and I don't see any outside or new ideas coming into a very closed decision-making process.
Well, welcome to the club, Peter B. Reading the Washington Post this morning, and, you know, it would be amusing if it weren't so serious, given the situation we face here with the wars and so forth. But a prominent spokesman for the White House was saying, you know, with Petraeus, Panetta, the Panera Bread. Oh, no, I didn't say Panera Bread. Petraeus, Panetta, and Crocker, you know, and that Marine guy who was the only guy who could speak without notes yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we couldn't find a better team. Well, you know, think about that. My goodness. They couldn't find a better team. You know, I mean, for Pete's sake, these guys are responsible for all manner of failure as well as death position, and they couldn't find a better team. Well, you're quite right. It's a very inbred, it's a very in-looking, and it's a very, very, what shall I say, insensitive team, because none of them, and I'd throw in Hillary there, who was lurking in the background, Hillary and, of course, Gates, none of them have any direct experience with the kind of suffering that they caused. It came to me, Peter B., in a microcosmic way, almost as a metaphor. When I stood before Hillary Clinton about 12 yards in front of her and I was brutalized. It was pretty violent. Those guys that came, jumped me, lifted me up, and dragged me out to the aisle. For what? For simply having stood with my back to her. And she, and people say, wasn't that amazing? She didn't miss a word. Well, she didn't miss a syllable.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't miss having seen what happened to me. And so metaphor, yeah, I think it's a metaphor for the ability of what my Irish grandmother used to call the upper crust, to simply be oblivious or to be in a studied way oblivious to the pain, the destruction, the loss of life that their policies caused. They can remain in this little bubble, this bubble illustrated by those distinguished people up there at the podium, and just live a normal life without any reflection on what kinds of disasters occur because of their policies. So that, that really speaks volumes, and that's why when they said they couldn't find another team, I said, oh, gosh, I wish they could find another. There are a lot of us around, I don't mean me. I mean people like, General Zinni or Larry Wilkerson or any number of people who know which end is up and are honest enough to say it.
So, Ray, without bringing in any new blood, it seems like the president isn't interested in anybody with different ideas from the inner circle that he has grown comfortable with, a lot of insiders, starting with the holdover Secretary of Defense who caused this game of musical chairs, Bobby Gates, as you like to call him, because you knew him back when.
Well, it was a lot sickening to hear the accolades thrown at Bobby Gates. His big, the thing that the fawning corporate media praise him for most slavishly is instituting the surge in Iraq, the surge with the help of General Petraeus. Now,
And Leon Panetta, who served on Bush's Iraq study group.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because Panetta and Gates also served in that group until he was nominated to take Rumsfeld's place.
Right.
That group came up with very, very sensible suggestions. First and foremost, no more troops to Iraq. For Pete's sake, no more troops to Iraq. And in that sense, they were saying the exact same thing that General Casey, commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, and General Abizaid, head of CENTCOM, were saying. They came back in September and October of 2006 and said, look, Mr. Senators and Representatives, we appreciate your support, but there's one thing we don't need. Please don't send any more troops.
Mm-hmm.
If you send more troops, these Iraqis will never get it through their head that they got to get their act together, get a decent government up there and start operating. Otherwise, if we send more troops, that's never going to happen. Well, what George Bush did at that point, very clearly, went to the American Enterprise Institute, where all manner of neocon advisors reside, and he said, okay, now I'm told that it's a feckless effort in Iraq. We're going to have to pull out sooner or later. What happens if I don't send any more troops? And the answer came back very simply, well, Mr. President, if you don't send any more troops, you're going to lose a war on your watch. And Bush said, well, that's not good. Well, draw me up a plan where I won't lose a war on my watch. And they drew up this plan. Send 20, 22, 23,000 more troops. We'll have a surge, and we'll do what's necessary to prevent you and Dick Cheney from having to leave Washington under a cloud, having lost the war. Now, then there was a problem. Rumsfeld what are we going to do about Rumsfeld? Well, they checked with Rumsfeld. You know what he told the president? Don't send any more troops. We got to get out of there. This is crazy. And this was right before the election in 2006. We have his memo.
Yep.
Okay? And so what does Bush do? Well, Bush says, oh, we got to get somebody to take Rumsfeld's place. Now, my God, we'll get him. Anyway. So he checks with, you know, he checks with his daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And he checks with George Tenet, who, you know, who was a friend of the Bushes. And, of course, George Tenet saved Bobby Gates' rear end when the Senate was not going to confirm Bobby Gates to be head of the CIA. George Tenet was the Senate Intelligence Committee staff director at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he owes a lot to this Bobby Gates, and now Gates would owe a lot to Tenet because Tenet and George H.W. Bush told the president, George W. Bush, hey, we got a guy, you know, he'd really like to be Secretary of Defense. He's been on the Iraq study group, so he knows a good bit about what's going on. He'll do what you want. All you have to do is make him Secretary of Defense. So what happens? 2 days before the election, Bush has Bobby Gates come to Crawford, and he says, hey, we got this new plan about Iraq. We're going to surge. And I know, Bobby, it seems like a fool's errand, but we got this guy with 10 rows of medals, 10, count them, on his left-hand breast. His name is Petraeus. We're going to make him out to be some sort of Petraeus ex machina, if you're okay. And we're going to say that, look, he saved...
Now, Ray, I just have to warn you, it's dangerous to rhyme things with Petraeus. Just ask moveon.org. But this is a good one.
Yeah, well, you know, it's for those listeners who weren't subjected to the torture of a classical education, they should know that in the old days, in the Greek tragedies, when the protagonist was in a helpless situation, you know, they were all closing in on him, and there was no way to go, no escape, well, then there was this machine.
Deus ex machina.
Yeah, and there would be a god attached to this machine, and the Derek would scoop down and literally pluck the hero out of danger, and so it became called a Deus ex machina, God from a machine, and that's how George W. Bush was sold by his father and George Tenet on the notion of, hey, this Petraeus, good-looking guy, hey, you know what? He went to Princeton. Yeah, he can read and write, and, you know, he's a comer. You have to realize that he's a real comer. As a matter of fact, you know, his classmates up there in West Point, they always described him as the kind of guy who would marry the commandant's daughter. As a matter of fact, that's what he actually did. Okay. Anyhow, here we are in Crawford, Texas, you know, and Bobby Gates says, well, tell me more about this Petraeus. And, of course, George Bush waxes eloquent about him, and Bobby Gates says, well, you know, it's a pretty daunting task. What am I going to have to do? Well, Petraeus will do the war. He'll do the surge. All you have to do is go out to Baghdad and tell Casey, General Casey, that he's got to retire, but not right away. We'll give him a sinecure. We'll make him Army Chief of Staff. But obviously, he's got to go because he's feeling his oats, and you know he's likely to squawk. And so we're going to make him retire. That's all you have to do: go to Baghdad and get Casey out of there, and go to Tampa, Florida, where CENTCOM exists, and tell obviously that's it. You know, and the Gates says, and then I can. And the president, you can be Secretary of Defense. And Gates says, okay, I think I can do that. Now, what was the upshot of that? Americans just don't know that what happened in Baghdad beginning in 2007 was not, as it was described by George Bush, an attempt to make sure that there were, some respite was given to Baghdad leaders so that they could get their act together and get a government that worked. No. What it was ethnic cleansing, transforming the capital of Iraq, Baghdad, from a predominantly Sunni city into a predominantly Shia city behind the protection of U.S. forces.
And blast walls that were built, erected to separate the populations.
That's right. And what most people don't know is that, number one, that WikiLeaks photography from the Apache gunship over Baghdad in July of 2007, that was at the height of the surge. Number two, that was typical of the kind of indiscriminate killing that went on in those days. And number three, that's what Bradley Manning saw. He saw not only that, but he saw young Iraqi university students being wrapped up and put in jail for writing critical term papers about the Iraqi government. And the rub there, of course, is that Bradley Manning knew exactly what was happening in Iraqi jails, and he faced up to the moral dilemma of being part of that. And to his great credit, the age of 22 years old, he said, "That's not for me. I need to tell the American people what's really going on here." And now, of course, he's in great jeopardy, sitting in a jail in Kansas. So anyhow, all these things happened. It wasn't only the ethnic cleansing in Baghdad. It was also paying off the Sunni out there in Anbar province,
right,
so that they would shoot at Al-Qaeda rather than shoot at us. And then, a masterful stroke, they persuaded Muqtada al-Sadr, the fiery Shiite cleric, to pursue his graduate studies in theology in Iran for a couple of years, and just, you know, get out of town and tamp the thing down among the Shia in Baghdad. So it worked. It worked like a charm, except what's the situation now? It's no better than it was before the surge. And what's the toll? The toll is 1,200 U.S. troops that are dead now, that wouldn't be dead if there were no surge, and countless tens of thousands of people in Baghdad and environs who are also dead or badly wounded or certainly driven from their homes. So, you know, the celebrated surge, I mean, you can celebrate it if you want, but that's what it was all about, and that's what the American people need to know and don't.
Now, General Petraeus has been somewhat like MacArthur in terms of feeling his own ego and his own, I guess, political independence, and has been willing to challenge at least the president's narrative regarding this so-called surge of troops in Afghanistan and the president's plan to start bringing those troops, some of them, home this summer, starting in July. And Petraeus, in public testimony before Congress, in comments in the media, has basically just said, that's not going to happen. And so given that his predecessor, McChrystal, was cashiered for intemperate remarks to Rolling Stone magazine, how is it that General Petraeus not only got away with that, but is getting promoted and coming back into Washington, where he's going to be in almost daily contact with the President of the United States?
Well, you know, Peter B., one has to take two steps back here and just realize how you get to be a four-star in the United States Army these days and who bubbles to the top. We're talking not only about Petraeus, we're talking about McChrystal and others. In my view, and I'll say this as a former Army officer, the conscience, the devotion to honor duty is lacking at the top ranks. Ambition is what rules the roost. Now, my own interpretation about McChrystal's firing, well, McChrystal, in my view, realized that after 6-8 months of the strategy that he was implementing, remember they were going to take that one town there in the south, and they were going to bring in a ready-made government and make that a model for taking Kandahar and the rest of them.
Sure.
Was a miserable failure. Mm-hmm. They still don't control that part of the country at night, and they expended the lives of a couple thousand Iraqis and some of our guys. Okay, so here's McChrystal realizing that his vaunted policies are not going to work. And so, in my view, he was very loose with his mouth, knowing full well that the Rolling Stone guy was going to publish this. He wanted to get fired. He wanted to get out of there. You know, he was, what was the title of that article? I remember. remember, was the...
I don't recall.
The missing general, or the general that... Well, the title seemed to be fitting in an ironic way because he was the general that wanted out of there. Generals can't quit, especially when they're losing or and pretending to be winning, and so he asked to be fired. He was cashiered by Obama because Obama had no other choice. Now, how about Petraeus? Well, he knows that to say that the successes, the progress, have been, well, they've been fragile and they're reversible. You know, you can only say that so many times before somebody's going to say, well, what do you mean, General? You know, how long are we going to have to stay there so that they become unfragile, you know, and irreversible? And then he'll say, what he said before, well, it's going to take generations. Your kids and our grandkids are going to be fighting it. Well, that's not acceptable. So what does he do? He, I think, outfoxed Obama. He's coming home, okay? The withdrawal, such as it will be in July, will, if it's substantial, let's say 10,000, 20,000 troops, then those gains or those fragile and not reversible gains are going to be reversed and unfragilized, okay? And who's going to be to blame for that? This idiot Obama, who insisted on this policy, and Petraeus will be able to sit back and say, you know, I kind of told you guys, why didn't you listen to me, you know? Now, if there's only a marginal withdrawal, Petraeus will be only slightly less well off, saying, well, you know, the president listened to me, and still there's going to be no, quote, prevailing, end quote, in that part of Afghanistan. So he's got it both ways. My bottom line is that Petraeus is very much interested in becoming president. I think he will be on the Republican ticket, if not this time, then in 5 years. I think that's the name of the game, and everything he is doing and likely to do in the interim, and especially he'll be able to do that being in Washington, will be to move the levers so that the Republicans will hire him on, and you know, who else they have, you know, who else they got, he'll be the candidate for sure, in my view.
So do you think that this is a political move on Obama's part to try to neutralize a potential challenger? And this invokes the old LBJ adage that I'd rather have him inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
Well, Peter B., I don't know if I would use your words, but yeah, I think so. Except the catch here is that Obama doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, you can't keep Petraeus inside the tent. Petraeus has got his own, as you've already pointed out, links to the military. And more important, Peter B., and this is something else people need to know, he's got very tight links to the pro-Israeli neocons.
Mm-hmm.
And this was revealed in a most unusual way by his inadvertent release of his own emails.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a story that would take 2 minutes to tell. I don't know if you want to spare the...
Let's do, and I want to refer to, I'll link to it in the show file at peterbcollins.com, but you wrote an excellent piece that's at consortiumnews.com where you recount this story about email exchanges with Max Boot.
Yeah. Now, Max Boot, of course, is the quintessential neocon. He was editor of the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. Now he's at the Council for Foreign Relations. Well, what happened was this. Somebody, probably one of Petraeus' staff, wrote something very sensible about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he said, you know, as long as this remains unresolved, we're just heaping up Islamic fanatics, Islamic dissidents, people who think that our identification with Israel and the billions of dollars of worth of arms and everything else we give them, that they think that this is unconscionable. And so they'll do everything they can to work against U.S. interests, to include terrorism. Well, they slipped something like that into his prepared remarks in a sort of anodyne way. You know, they simply said that this makes it more difficult. The conflict increases anti-American sentiment. This is a quote. Due to a perception of U.S. favoritism for Israel, end quote. Well, okay. I mean, then it says Al-Qaeda and other militant groups exploit that anger and mobilize support, end quote. Well, you know, that I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that, but that you don't say that. You don't say that in Washington. The neocons consider that anathema. You can't say something that would reflect badly on Israel or, worse still, indicate that you really think they should show some flexibility on the Palestinian issue. So what did Petraeus do? Well, after he issued that written statement but avoided saying it in public before Congress, it got a bit of notice, you know, internet, even in some of the fawning corporate media. They know, what is this, you know? And so what does he do? He writes to Max Boot, and he says, look, please, remember, I didn't say that. It was in, you know, it was in my written submission, but I didn't say it. Am I in trouble? And Max Boot says, well, no, I've just written an op-ed which the title of which is, quote, a lie that David Petraeus is anti-Israel. And Petraeus wouldn't stop. He says, well, you know, what do I need to do? And this is a direct quote from the email, quote, does it help, folks? Does it help if folks know that I hosted Elie Wiesel and his wife at our quarters on Sunday night? Would it help if they knew that I was a speaker for the 65th anniversary of the liberation from the concentration camps? What do I need to do? And finally, Boot answers, look, relax. No, I don't think you have to do that because you're no longer being accused of being anti-Semitic. And that's when Petraeus responds, Roger, exclamation point. And then he types in, you know,
a smiley face.
And a dash and a, you know, a smile face.
Yeah.
So, you know, this kind of pandering, you know, we're going to have this from the director of the Central Intelligence Agency now. This is real, real trouble. And the guy is just really so ambitious that he will cater to the Zionist lobby in a way that that fellow Chaz Freeman, who was turned down for the head of analysis in the intelligence community, would never have done. And so the president is depriving himself, probably quite knowingly, of any balance in addressing this issue as well, and that's trouble ahead.
Now, Ray, David Petraeus is not the first general to report to duty as the leader of the Central Intelligence Agency. But I'm very uncomfortable with this this swap of a soldier for a spook and a spook for director of the Pentagon, the head of the War Department. And I think it sends a terrible message that our intelligence and military operations are deeply intertwined at all levels, and that the heads of these agencies are therefore interchangeable. And I'm just curious your reaction to that, and then I'd like you to address what kind of a welcome Petraeus will get from the lifers, the people who are the long-term dedicated employees of the CIA.
Yeah, well, those are really interesting questions. The first one has to do with managing things. The intelligence community, with double the budget that it had before 9/11, double, and the Defense Department, which is not cutting back. This is a mythology that they're, you know, reducing their expenses. They need good, principled people with integrity managing them, okay? People who are more interested in the country than themselves or a particular party. Now, Panetta is the quintessential bureaucrat. When he was up for confirmation as head of the CIA, he described himself. He says, quote, I'm a creature of Congress, end quote. Okay. So his role at the CIA was simply to interface with Congress, smooth over edges. After all, you need somebody really adept to smooth over torture, kidnapping, putting people in black holes without telling their wives, their families, much less the Red Cross, and then destroying the evidence. I mean, you need a really accomplished insider to do that.
And don't forget the drone attacks. Those are primarily controlled by the agency.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, here's a guy who was able to do that with Congress, and now they're depending on him to do the same with the Defense Department, which, of course, spends X times as much money as the intelligence community. So Panetta has been an incredible disappointment to me. You know, before he took charge of the CIA, he had written an article. article that said the torture is beyond the pale. We should never be involved in that. As soon as he gets into CIA, he reverses tune completely. So,
well, you know, and Ray, you and I have spoken before about the very chilling exchange between him and Senator Kit Bond in his confirmation hearing, where Bond just excoriated Panetta for having opposed torture and rendition.
Mm-hmm.
And Bond basically said, you know, what are you basing that on? And Panetta said, well, you know, public media reports. Everybody knows about this. And Bond basically made him recant what he had said.
Yeah.
And Panetta was willing to do so. That sent an even more serious red flag for me.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, Peter B., frankly, I find it, you know, I should be inured to this by now, but I find it extremely, extremely upsetting. You may recall that when Panetta was named, I said, hey, here's a guy like me. He got out of a Jesuit college the same year I did. He was in the Army, same way I was as a young Army officer. He has some ethics. He even says he doesn't like torture. This is going to be great. He's going to go in there and clean house. What did he do? He comes to Washington. Not only does he not clean house, he lets the same guys who are running the torture, the rendition, and everything else, lets them stay in and run the agency for the next couple years. What does he do? He acts as their lawyer, defending them down on the Hill and everywhere else. So the guy has no sympathy for me. There was a clip played during an interview I did yesterday. Amy Goodman, I think it was, played a clip where Panetta is remonstrating with some interviewing, saying, look, drones? Yes, drones. We're defending the country. And those people that say this is illegal, they don't know what they all they know is that they should know is we're defending the country. And I'm saying to myself, how does Hellfire missiles from drones over Pakistan, how does that translate into defending our country? For God's sake, what it's doing is adding tens of thousands of militants or, you know, whatever you want to call them, insurgents, people who hate us. Why? They hate us for our democracy? No. They hate us because we leveled their villages. That's why they hate us. So this guy is a my Irish father, you know, he was very, very, he never used real expletives, but the worst one that came out of his mouth was, he's a fathead. Well, that's what Panetta is, you know. And you can tell all your friends in California that that's what I think of him. Now, with respect to the lifers at the CIA, well, I think maybe you and I have discussed this before, but people need to know, they really need to know, that there are two CIAs, okay? The one that Truman envisaged, the one that he set up, and the one that he praised, and that was the analysis division, which was to have possession of all the information on a given country or issue, you know, unlike Pearl Harbor, where there was no central place for all that stuff, and would be able to speak truth to power. What Truman wanted was to be able to say, hey, Mr. Director, I want you to come over here from Virginia. I want to know what you and those two universities' worth of specialists out there in the woods of Virginia, I want to know what you really think about, for example, about these blue-suited generals that are telling me that if they use this new instrument, it's called a B-52. Now, if they drop bombs from the B-52, they're going to seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Ho Chi Minh's going to give up, so will Jop. And we'll be sitting pretty. What do you guys think of that? Well, I was there, all right? We suppressed the laugh. Why? For two reasons. Number one, Ho Chi Minh Trail didn't look like anything like, you know, the 5 or I-66 or I-95.
Uh-huh.
It was like 180 little things through the jungle, okay? You couldn't even see most of it from the air. And then this business about Ho Chi Minh giving up. I was sitting next to one of the guys from our predecessor of Special Forces, it was called the OSS in those days, who brought Ho Chi Minh literally into Hanoi when the Japs, when the Japanese were driven out, on their shoulders. He looked at me and he says, oh, yeah, right, Ho Chi Minh is going to give up if we start bombing. Give me a break. Have we learned nothing? So, long story short, We told the president, we waited a decent interval for two days, and then we said, Mr. President, ain't no way, no matter how many bombs you drop or how many fancy planes you fly, ain't going to win this war, okay? Now, the rest of the story, of course, is that LBJ, like George W. Bush, was set on not losing a war, and thereon hangs the tale of what happened after those years. But that's the kind of information, that's the kind of analysis that Truman expected and what he got, okay? Now, what happened with this? Why is it that this other CIA, and there are two, this other one, this operational arm, why is it they get involved in torture, rendition, black prisons, and all that kind of stuff? Well, when the OSS came back from World War II, I mean, these were imaginative, creative guys, gutsy guys, women as well. They came into Washington and said, thanks for all the applause. Do you still need us? And the question answered itself. The Soviets had already overrun Eastern Europe. The KGB was all over the world. Of course we need you. And then some idiot, Peter B., and I used the word advisedly, some idiot said, hey, we're creating this Central Intelligence Agency for analysis. But it's working with secret stuff. Let's fold the OSS, the covert operators, the overthrowers of government, the paymasters of political parties, let's fold them into this analysis unit. One sentence, Peter B., one sentence in the National Security Act of 1947, quote, justified this, end quote. It said, Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence that the President of the United States shall from time to time direct, period, end quote. Now, that gives an unscrupulous president, a president with no integrity, a president with no sense of right and wrong, like George W. Bush, that gives that president the idea that he can create his own personal Gestapo. And do not blanch before that word, because that's what happened. All he needs is a willing sycophant like George Tenet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you want me to find some torturers? We don't have any torturers on board, but we know, yeah, sure, we can do that. All that's needed is that, and then number two, equally important, a Congress that has no guts, a Congress that will not chance being called soft on terrorism. So you get Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein, and the con guys from CIA and Langley come down and say, well, now we want to tell you about these harsh interrogation techniques. We're going to, we don't need to know any more than that. Yeah, sure, use them, And then, a year later, it comes out that we're torturing people, and Feinstein and Pelosi say, we never told about that. And the guys from CIA say, we have a memo of that conversation June 22nd, 2004, and we wanted to tell you, but the note says here that you didn't want to hear any more. What's necessary is an unscrupulous president, an unscrupulous head of intelligence, and a Congress that has no guts, and then you get what you've got, all the abuses of this other CIA. Now, one little caveat here. We do need a clandestine service, but that clandestine service should support the analysis part of the CIA. That's necessary to run spies, to run people who can tell us things we can't ferret out any other way. But if you're going to have people that overthrow governments, if you're going to have people that do these other things, well, create something else to do that. And that's not my idea. You know whose idea that was? Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm.
Look it up. December 22nd. 1963, an op-ed in the Washington Post, which appeared, quite curiously, only in the initial edition, not in the subsequent two editions of the Washington Post, and that was embargoed, didn't appear in any of the other mainstream media, so-called. December 22nd, 1963, exactly 1 month after John Kennedy was assassinated, and we know from Truman's own notes in Independence, Missouri, that there was a causal connection between that assassination and his op-ed.
Now, Ray, as Petraeus takes over at CIA, he comes with considerable baggage, in my view. He is invested in the surge in Iraq and a successful ending to our involvement there, however that is defined. And he is also heavily invested in the success of what he has initiated in Afghanistan. And you raised the point in your essay at Consortium News that he is not going to be open, most likely, and the people in the analysis branch there at the CIA are going to be guarded about presenting information to him that contradicts the legacies that he is so busy working on.
Well, that's correct. I mean, picture yourself as the analyst on Afghanistan, okay? And you've been there, you've looked at it, you've analyzed the heck out of it, and you realize that this is a fool's errand. You realize that nobody is going to, quote, prevail from the outside, end quote, in Afghanistan. And you've been writing. As to their credit, the analysts have been writing that this is the case. I cite two estimates. One, a national intelligence estimate prepared and delivered late last year on Afghanistan. And that one said, ain't no way, I'll use the vernacular here, okay, ain't no way you're going to win, you're going to prevail in any real sense if you can't persuade the Pakistanis to change their strategic outlook and seal the border so the insurgents can't get into Afghanistan, okay? That was the one on Afghanistan. Now, there was a companion estimate, a national intelligence estimate. That's the supreme genre of analytic work. Another one on Pakistan. And again, to use the vernacular, that one said, ain't no chance or ain't even a snowball's chance in hell that you're going to be able to change the strategic outlook of the Pakistani leaders. They don't like India. They fear India for what they consider to be very good reasons, and their whole outlook is shaped by that attitude, and you're not going to be able to persuade them, no matter how eloquently you try, and I don't know how many times you send Hillary Clinton and others there, like Mike Mullen, you're not going to be able to persuade them that they should have the same attitude you do, to consider the Indians very nice people, after all, and the real problem being insurgents, terrorists, okay? That's not going to work, because the objectives of Pakistan and Afghanistan are pure and simple to deny Afghanistan from becoming under primary Indian influence as it had been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way that the Pakistanis are going to stop supporting the Taliban toward that end. They need to have a lot of influence in Afghanistan. And, you know, they are not only equipping, paying, leading, but they're actually running some of the assassination squads against not only Afghan officials, but against their own troops. So it's a heck of a situation. You know, Mike Mullen, Admiral Mullen, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he was there this past week. He was tearing out his hair. I don't understand. General Kiani, he doesn't see things. He doesn't see it the way we do, you know. Well, that's hubris. That's just, that comes from this inbred atmosphere that we know what's right for everybody. And surely, surely, they will start loving the Indians and hating the terrorists, and then everything's going to be all right. So, sorry to be so long-winded here, but okay, here's an analyst that knows all that, right, Peter B.?
Mm-hmm.
And now he's going to write a nice little memo of five pages and tell the director of the CIA, General Petraeus, that this is the case, and if he didn't know this before, well, maybe that's his saving grace. But if he did know this and advocated surges and all this other stuff, you know, he's a pretty dumb guy. Now, how long is that analyst going to last as the analyst on Afghanistan? Well, one can say, well, maybe Petraeus has more integrity than we give him credit for, and he welcomed that kind of thing. But I wouldn't want to make any bets on that. And that is very, very dangerous, because if you get the intelligence people seconding what the military people are saying about a little progress here, some, you know, it's not reversible, it's not irreversible, and it's tentative, but, you know, if you get them saying that, well, then Obama will be able to palliate or tamp down the criticism, and he thinks win the next election. But you know what? Remember where you heard it first. it's going to redound to his, not to his benefit, but to his disgrace. And by the time he's running in another year or so, people are going to see through all this. And, God, I fear for what will happen, because as bad as Obama has been, as spineless and as willing to cave in to people like Petraeus, you know, what's the alternative?
Ray, I really appreciate your honest commentary on this fascinating history and context that's unavailable for many Americans in the media. And I just thank you for stepping forward. And I hope that you'll be asked to testify at the confirmation hearing of General Petraeus for his new job at the CIA.
Well, I went to Bobby Gates' nomination hearing, but no one asked me to testify, so I'll try to get there. But maybe my Code Pink friends and I can testify in our own way.
All right. Ray McGovern, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Bye now.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. Still to come, Will Durst's commentary on the birther madness. Joining me now is Professor Jonathan Stevenson. He teaches strategic studies at the Naval War College in Connecticut. He is a contributor to Harper's Magazine, and he has a fascinating and quite timely piece in the forthcoming, the new issue of Harper's, the May 2011 issue, which is on newsstands now. And it's called Owned by the Army, Has the President Lost Control of His Generals? Professor, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Peter.
Now, you have an interesting background. You are a civilian professor there at the Naval War College. You have a background as a journalist. You spent the 1990s in sub-Saharan Africa and Northern Ireland. And you have two books to your credit. Back in the 90s, you published We Wrecked the Place, Contemplating an End to the Northern Irish Troubles and Losing Mogadishu. And more recently, you wrote Thinking Beyond the Unthinkable, Harnessing Doom from the Cold War to the Age of Terror. And tell us, did you have any inkling of the shuffle that President Obama announced this week, trading Panetta for Gates at the Pentagon and moving Petraeus in to take over for Panetta as the head of the Central Intelligence Agency?
I had heard about it from you know, contacts that I have in government in Washington, and actually in a couple of speculative newspaper articles a few weeks ago. So it didn't surprise me that much.
But this piece had to go to bed before that speculation even surfaced, right?
It did, yeah, long before.
Well, then that makes you a visionary. Now, summarize for our listeners the precis here, because you, in a thoughtful way, point out that General Petraeus has departed from some of the behavioral norms of leading generals, at least in the recent past.
Yeah, I mean, I guess where I'd start in summarizing the article is that, you know, before the Civil War, civil-military relations in the United States were very politicized and sort of shambolic. Civil War was a kind of a watershed, and from there, a professional military class did evolve that was relatively unpoliticized and technocratic, and waited patiently and prepared for the time of the nation's greatest need. And the officers it produced did duly recognize civilian authority in strategic affairs all the way up through the two world wars. Then you had the one major civilian-military confrontation of national proportions in the 20th century between President Truman and General MacArthur,
right,
over the conduct of the Korean War. And even that, although Truman was unpopular for a while over his dismissal of MacArthur, I think it ultimately served to affirm civilian control after Truman replaced MacArthur with a very quiet, steady, and very highly competent General Matthew Ridgway.
Mm-hmm. And notably, General Petraeus has very publicly, basically rebuffed the president's narrative that he delivered at your competing war college at West Point on December 1st of 2009. And the president announced this so-called surge in Afghanistan, with the immediate caveat that those troops would start coming home in July of this year. It's a very quick uptick of U.S. presence there, at least based on the president's plans in 2009. But shortly thereafter, Petraeus made a number of very public statements that didn't directly contradict the president. He just offered a very different sequence of events and projections.
Yes, he essentially, in a number of cases, he just ignored the July 2011 date and chose instead to focus eventually on NATO's date of 2014 for the major pullout, which gave him, obviously would have given him a lot more operational leeway in terms of counterinsurgency. And he did this fairly publicly. And I guess one of the things I would contend is that this really does seem to cut against the sort of accepted theory of civil-military relations, which Samuel P. Huntington of Clash of Civilizations fame posited in 1957, which is called the theory of objective control. And it says that there should be military obedience to civilian leaders in areas of strategic or political discretion, which overall strategy would be, and civilian deference to the military on operational and tactical matters. What I'm suggesting is that General Petraeus, you know, in going on TV and sort of challenging or at least questioning or not directly embracing the president's July 2011 drawdown date, was in fact getting into the realm of politics and strategy.
And as you point out, General McChrystal was sacked for his indiscreet remarks that were quoted, some indirectly attributed to him, in the Rolling Stone piece. And you quote in Harper's here the president's statement for firing McChrystal because he undermined the civilian control of the military that is at the core of our democratic system. So McChrystal got fired. Now he's been rehabilitated and been put in charge of a veterans task force. And Petraeus basically thumbed his nose at the example of McChrystal, and he's getting promoted and brought back stateside as a result.
In a way, I think you can look at it in a way that gives President Obama a little bit more credit for, I won't say Machiavellian, but subtle cleverness, and I think you can at least read it as getting Petraeus out of Afghanistan and giving him responsibility for a much wider array of problems at a much broader strategic level that doesn't involve direct command over military assets is a form of kicking him upstairs, and allows Obama to eliminate a fairly big barrier to policy flexibility on Afghanistan without causing a politically damaging rupture of relations between the White House and the Pentagon.
And Professor, in the preceding segment, Ray McGovern, the retired CIA analyst, speculated that this is a way of preventing Petraeus from running against Obama for president next year.
I mean, that could be. I don't honestly think. I've harbored serious doubts that Petraeus would run or even wanted to, although the weakness of the GOP field may make his candidacy a more prominent possibility. So I guess there's something to what Mr. McGovern said. But maybe in a more immediate policy sense, it could be the president is clearing the way for an adjustment of the Afghanistan policy that's more in line with Vice President Biden's counterterrorism plus prescription.
But with Petraeus controlling intelligence and the drone war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, doesn't that, you described it as being kicked upstairs, but Petraeus still has a very powerful role in the war in Afghanistan and the unacknowledged war in Pakistan.
That's true, the side comment here is that he has poor relationship with Pakistan.
Well, the New York Times on Friday the 29th here is reporting just that, and that the Pakistanis are very concerned about this new job for Petraeus.
Which is going to make it, if anything, harder for the CIA to prosecute the drone war.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm sure this has occurred to the Obama people, and that fact may, you know, may also telegraph some kind of major change in both in so-called AFPAC policy.
Mm-hmm. And what direction would you speculate that that might go? I'm certainly looking for a change myself, because I think that we are in a very difficult position. A quagmire is not too strong enough of a term. And Petraeus has offered measured statements of progress without overpromising. So where do you see the potential for a shift in Afghanistan?
I think the shift would be towards de-escalation. I mean, I don't think there's going to be any precipitous withdrawal, but one that, you know, is certainly less bullish on the idea of, you know, peeling away elements of the Taliban by cutting deals with them, and also with full-blooded counterinsurgency, because I think that Petraeus' statements of progress have been pretty qualified even for him, and he's in favor of counterinsurgency. And you know, I think the movement would be towards cutting our losses and trying to turn over the situation to Afghan forces sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree, by the way, I agree with you broadly that it's not working.
Mm-hmm. And, Professor, as we look at a general at the CIA, and he's not the first, I believe Petraeus will be the sixth or seventh person to take off a uniform and run the intelligence agency. But is this a further blurring of the distinction between the Pentagon and the intelligence community, which is certainly much more than the CIA? And do you have concerns about that?
Well, I think it does reflect the fact that the CIA has undertaken more and more paramilitary operations, such as drone strikes and commando operations, on the one hand, and that the Pentagon wants a bigger piece of intelligence. So, there is a convergence and a kind of blurring of the distinction.
And why not just merge them?
From my own point of view, that would not be a good idea, because it would tinge the collection and analysis of intelligence too heavily with military concerns. I think that it's good to have an independent, civilian intelligence agency.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the points Ray McGovern raised, and he has, a sense of turf about the agency that he served for so long. But he's concerned that the analysts will not be able to counter the twin legacies of General Petraeus. And explicitly, if an analyst comes with a negative projection about Iraq or Afghanistan that conflicts with the legacy of General Petraeus, how will the general view that? And will the process work in the best interests of the nation and not in the political interests or even the personal biographical interests of Mr. Petraeus?
I think that's a very valid fear on the part of Mr. McGovern, because, as you know, as I suggest in the article, Petraeus is larger than life. He's larger than his own position, and he has a huge amount of prestige and status, and I suspect will be willing to throw his weight around in the agency context. And I think that, you know, the agency sensitivities to that kind of thing are very understandable, given the way in which intelligence was politicized in the run-up to the Iraq War, and how I think the analysts, in a way, were sold out by a CIA director whose career was basically in hock to the White House, and who was therefore willing to acquiesce in the politicization of intelligence after 9/11. Talking about George Tenet.
Indeed. And we're talking with Professor Jonathan Stevenson at the Naval War College. His article is in the new issue of Harper's Magazine. And let me quote, Professor, "Something is clearly wrong with our relationship with the military, and the problem runs deeper than arch missives to the troops, presumptuous TV interview banter, or the propriety of combat unit questionnaires." There you're referring to Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Right.
"Our generals are getting bolder, and we've lost our ability to recognize when they are overstepping their constitutional powers. This is not the threat of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke about. This is new. The military isn't trying to ramp up spending. It's interjecting its voice into the sphere of statecraft as it never has before. That is a very strong indictment, Professor.
Yes, and it's not one that I wrote down, you know, cavalierly, or that my editor shaped cavalierly. It was collaborative, but I think it really is borne out by some of the reporting that Bob Woodward did in his, I thought, excellent book, Obama's Wars, where you actually have. Generals candidly stating to him, I'm thinking of General Lute in particular, who actually occupies mainly a civilian role in the National Security Organization, saying that Petraeus was trying to shape the strategic agenda and trying to circumscribe the president's options in Afghanistan. I think it's important to. For me to emphasize that the problem, despite the sort of dramatic sounding statement of the problem, which isn't inaccurate that you just quoted, it's still a problem of a fairly subtle nature. Elsewhere in the article, I make it clear that I'm not contending that the U.S. military harbors an institutionalized, conspiratorial, anti-civilian disposition. I don't think it does, or that the U.S. government is vulnerable to a sort of tanks at the White House, 7 days in May coup. I would worry more about what I call a kind of coup d'esprit, in which the civilian leadership acquiesces to military thinking about strategic problems. The problem with to have a very can-do attitude that focuses them more narrowly on strategic problems to lack the perspective that civilians have about the limits of American power.
And, Professor, in one passage here, you make a comment that implies that you agree with the notion that Bush's surge in Iraq was, you call it a tactical success. And
As opposed to a strategic success.
Okay. Explain what you mean then.
Well, I think probably Petraeus and, by extension, Bush get more credit than they deserve for what appeared to be a calming of the situation in Iraq following the surge. But because I think much of it was overdetermined. Before the surge occurred, al-Qaeda in Iraq had overplayed its hand, and the Sunnis, who had made a sort of an alliance of convenience with al-Qaeda, turned against it because al-Qaeda started to throw its weight around and get too brutal. And that's what really spurred the awakenings movement among the Sunnis, and I would give Petraeus in general and the U.S. more broadly some credit for exploiting that, and nudging the awakenings movement on board by basically bribing them.
Yeah,
and creating militias.
And where does bribery show up as a military tactic?
I think it probably shows up on the ground quite a bit more than we think it does.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
The other piece of it really was the separation of Sunni and Shia through essentially a kind of ethnic cleansing and partitioning. Baghdad is a far different city than it was 10 years ago.
Exactly, and it does, and none of that erases the fact that you still have a Sunni-dominated government. Quite a bit influenced by Iran, that feels as though it's been abused for generations and wants payback. And that's a difficult circle to square.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whether Iraq can stabilize and be a functioning polity that tamps down sectarianism certainly remains to be seen. So,
Professor, if I may, one more question about Iraq. What is your comment on the recent overtures from Washington to Baghdad saying we'll leave troops there in the number of 17,000 or more if you just ask us? And this seems to violate the SOFA agreement negotiated between Bush and Maliki. It violates the campaign promises made by President Obama. And it leaves many of us unclear as to what the U.S. real intention is regarding full withdrawal from Iraq.
I think it's residual worry about this, about the political center holding, if it exists at all, in Iraq, and about Iranian influence. 17,000 troops isn't, in the scheme of American security architecture, all that many. It's a division, basically.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And I think the idea would be that it'd be there for quick reaction to backstop a duly elected and constituted regime if it came under pressure from the outside or from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's enough troops to warrant the idea that we want Iraq to become a military outpost.
And what about the enduring bases that the U.S. has built there?
I mean, again, I think that, there's probably some sense that we don't want to forsake them, and that having boots on the ground is a way to keep them relevant. On the other hand, I think that that's got to be balanced against sensitivities in the area that have only risen with the Arab Spring, to an American military presence or an American attempt to co-opt an Arab regime, particularly one that's not us, that's at least stands a chance of not being autocratic and repressive.
Mm-hmm. And, Professor, I'm glad you mentioned the Arab Spring, because I did want to ask you about this. I see an opportunity for a complete reevaluation of American policy in the region as it relates to Israel, as it relates to the states headed by dictators and royals that we have been embracing for perhaps too long. And I'm curious if you see the flexibility in our military and intelligence leadership to look at this opportunity, get beyond the desire for the status quo and stability, and envision a remaking of our relationships in ways that would be healthier for our national interests and for efforts to return the region to a much more peaceful posture.
Yeah, I think there is that opportunity, but I think it's going to be tough, because, at least in the short term, because we have a moving target. I mean, just looking at Israel's relationship to the Palestinians and the Syrians, for example,
mm-hmm.
That alone is going to be very difficult to navigate, simply just on the basis of what's happened in the past week. Egypt becoming more sympathetic to Hamas, and Syria sort of in disarray and not as predictable as it used to be. So I think that in the long term, it's going to be very difficult to shape American policy. But what you say about there being an opportunity is true. Obama, I think, has managed Egypt fairly well in supporting what was essentially a secular protest.
And can I jump in there, because I agree, but I was very concerned during late January when we were cozying up to Omar Suleiman, the instant vice president that Mubarak desperately appointed and then tried to hand off leadership to. And Suleiman, while a good friend of the United States and of Israel, is the guy who ran the machinery of repression. And he was our vendor for torture when we wanted to kidnap people and render them to a third nation. And we did that on many occasions during the last 10 years. So I was very concerned that the administration seemed prepared to accept Suleiman and work with him. And it appears that the Egyptian generals have pretty much foreclosed that.
I think you've identified the pivotal moment. I think that was a moment of deep indecision and on the part of the administration, and conflict within it about what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The realists were saying we've got to stick with the guy who's been so reliable over the past 30 years.
And the Saudis were echoing that in a very big way.
Yes, because potentially you know, it would have been negative precedent in their own situation. But I think the idealists prevailed, and I think they have in general on the Arab Spring, including the intervention in Libya,
mm-hmm.
Which was driven mainly by Secretary of State Clinton. Susan Rice.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about the so-called humanitarian hawks?
You know, I think that it's going to be necessary that for them to calibrate whatever principle, if one does emerge from the Libya intervention, make it clear exactly what the precedent is and what is and is not going to precipitate that kind of intervention. And it's not just, and I think that that's important not only in managing expectations in the Middle East, but also Africa, which has manifested some, through the AU, some displeasure
mm-hmm.
with the Libyan intervention.
And this brings us back really to your discussion in the article about the tension between political and military leaders. And so on the one hand, we see that Gates put out clear markers that he certainly didn't want to intervene in Libya with any kind of ground forces. And so the no-fly zone and the NATO umbrella were created, and they did get some authorization from the United Nations. And you know, I appreciate that up to a point. I'm still a kind of fundamentalist on war powers. And whether it's a Democrat or Republican, I don't like to see military operations launched without congressional approval. That said, I think the president did this in the best way possible, given that set of issues. I still have concerns that we have one standard for Libya and a very different standard for Bahrain and Syria. And Bahrain, in particular, has become a proxy situation where the Saudis rolled troops and police officers in there, I think basically to remind the United States that they will not permit a revolution to occur in Bahrain because it's too similar to the makeup of the population and the politics in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Libya it was very opportunistic in a way because the administration knew everybody hated Gaddafi. So they were going to get the consent of the Arab League and the UN. And whereas with Syria, there are greater sensitivities because of its linkage with Iran and Hezbollah, I think. With Bahrain, obviously, there is a direct interest in maintaining military connections because that's where the Fifth Fleet is based.
Mm-hmm.
So prudential considerations do come into play, and there's only so far that a liberal interventionist principle can go. I think it's important for the U.S. to articulate with some clarity exactly, you know, how much of a precedent Libya is, if it is one at all. But I do think, you know, sort of in terms of mood music, if not actual strategic operations, the Libya intervention seems, it's regarded increasingly in Washington as at least the beginning of a kind of reassertion of authority on the part of civilian officials, in particular liberal hawks,
mm-hmm.
over the use of military force and a more critical focus on what is and isn't likely to work from a strategic point of view. And that might be a silver lining in terms of broader policy issues. And, of course, the big question is whether the shift in perspective will carry over to Afghanistan.
A couple of more quotes from your article in Harper's. The United States' current crypto-imperial strategy, however, is decidedly anti-realist. With a military budget at their disposal that dwarfs that of our nearest rival, American statesmen feel little compulsion to restrain themselves when projecting our power abroad. They may genuinely worry about, say, impinging on Russia's sphere of influence in Central Asia or trampling Muslim sensitivities, but the war against transnational terrorists overrides all such concerns. The perceived threat to America's global interests is great. Its weapons are superior to those of its enemies, and its forward deployments are ready to be used quickly, decisively, and with extreme prejudice. The result has been a decline in statecraft and the careless transfer of authority to the military. Now, this is another very powerful statement that you've made. Can you amplify that a little bit, please?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking mainly about Afghanistan and about the fact that it's become a kind of a test bed for the counterinsurgency doctrine that Petraeus himself incorporated into U.S. military doctrine. The fact that, you know, a kind of maximalism and in the use of counterinsurgency to counter terrorism has prevailed, I think, bears it out. I mean, the late Richard Holbrooke, for example, was very worried about military operations essentially overtaking diplomacy in Afghanistan, and really favored an approach that was far, far more focused on diplomacy and much less so on counterinsurgency and what amounts to nation building. Obama rejected that, and for a number of reasons. One was, you know, the fact that he backed himself into a corner by calling Afghanistan a war of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
I think in order to distinguish it from the, you know, increasingly clearly idiotic war of choice in Iraq. I think the other was that the apparent success of the surge basically made the generals bureaucratically the flavor of the month and gave them a lot more hand in shaping policy for a president who wasn't terribly experienced in managing conflict, overseas conflict.
And let me read the parts of the final two paragraphs of your article. You refer to Petraeus here. You say he has continued to angle for a long-term commitment in Afghanistan. He is neither as naive nor as grandiose as MacArthur was. To the contrary, he has a very keen sense of what the market for military assertiveness will bear. That makes his swagger all the more worrisome. He knows what he can get away with. He has continued to play the warrior statesman, using his position as one pro-Petraeus Obama administration official admitted to the New York Times, quote, to shape public opinion and narrow the president's options. And you close by saying, you run through a couple of options and you say perhaps there's a third. He could restore a healthy inequality to civil-military relations by announcing, in defiance of his own grace period, a policy of strategic de-escalation forthwith. That would be kind of a coup, you say.
Right.
Well, this is very interesting. First of all, doesn't this get you into trouble?
Well, it could. I mean, I could get some nasty emails, but... Mm-hmm. But you know, the Naval War College is a professional educational institution, and it does let us say in independent publications more or less what we want. I could see coming in for some criticism, but I haven't so far.
Mm-hmm.
Since the article's been out for a couple of weeks, perhaps you know, my expectation that I won't get into much trouble, if any, is increasingly justified. You know, even if I did, I wouldn't back off from the substance of what I say.
Mm-hmm. Now, to your point here about Petraeus, he can get away with it and he knows what he can get away with. Do you think that he will change his behavior at CIA or will use his access to information, intelligence, and state secrets to, quote, shape public opinion and, quote, narrow the president's options? Is he some sort of an overseer of the president? And here the president is giving him a new shot at influencing the administration in very powerful ways.
I don't think so. I think at CIA, he actually is under greater constraints in terms of the degree of discretion and confidentiality that's expected of him. The worries about his bringing to bear his own military point of view within the agency that Mr. McGovern talked about, I think, are, you know, well placed. I think those are real concerns. But in terms of his using his powers of persuasion or bureaucratic power within the interagency process, as opposed to the intra-agency one, I think he's much more restricted.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not on the ground, he has his responsibilities are you know, much more dispersed. And
yeah.
I just don't think he's going to have quite the degree of drag on specific problems like Afghanistan that he did have when he was commander of ground forces there or of military forces there, or when he was CENTCOM commander.
And, Professor, I always like to give you an opportunity to add anything or cover anything I may have left out here in closing. What would you like to contribute here?
I think, well, it's been a very well-conducted interview, so I think you've covered most of the issues. I guess the one thing I would say, maybe to wrap it up, is that I'm not trying to suggest that civilian leaders always have a better idea. Indeed, George W. Bush had to look to a talented and capable general, Petraeus, to at least in the public eye bail him out of the mess that he's gotten into in Iraq. But I do think that, generally speaking, the elected civilian leader is a better bet as the long-term steward of U.S. strategy, because he or she is charged with and accustomed to balancing the full range of national concerns, fiscal strain as well as strategic blowback. Whereas combatant commanders have to focus narrowly on, what resources their assigned missions need and, the welfare and morale of their troops. And for that reason, civilian supremacy in the civil-military relationship makes the most systemic sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it would be healthiest for the country if that supremacy were reasserted and reestablished. And the opportunity, of course, presents itself most prominently in Afghanistan. And I have guardedly optimistic feelings about the direction the administration is moving in on this.
Well, it's the most encouragement I've heard in a while, Professor. So thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Jonathan Stevenson, Professor of Strategic Studies, Naval War College. Read his piece in the May issue of Harper's Magazine. And now, San Francisco-based stand-up comic and sit-down satirist, Will Durst, weighs in on the latest birther controversies.
Hey guys, Will Durst here, hoping that the president, by releasing the long form of his certificate of live birth from the state of Hawaii, has finally laid this nonsense to rest, but suspecting no, probably not. The birther bozos are regrouping as we speak to find a new nose to wear. First the short form, then the long form, next the want the director's cut. Anything to make him seem different, not like a real American. Who knows, maybe the flippo units on the right are going to demand proof he's not a Muslim, and they won't be satisfied until they see a signed parchment from Allah. This is not going to end the controversy. People believe what they want to believe. Facts be damned. Hell, 30% of the GOP still believes Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. Half of them gotta be convinced that Bill Clinton has tiny squirrels in his pants. The shame is, Obama was forced to hold a televised press conference not to address the reshuffling of his national security team, but rather where he was born. His exact quote was, "We're not going to be able to do our jobs if we get distracted by sideshows and carnival barkers." And the main carnival barker in question, Donald Trump, said he was honored to be responsible for making the president jump through these hoops. You know, he's that kid in high school too dim to realize the teacher's making fun of him. You'd think that in the face of concrete evidence, the Donald would back off, but you'd be as wrong as Blaze Orange Camel. Now, he says he can't understand how a guy named Barack Hussein Obama got into Harvard Law, and he wants to see his college transcripts, which is a really, really polite way of calling the President of the United States the N-word. What's next? Moles? Does the President have any moles? And if so, how many of them are shaped like Cuba? What I want is for Trump to provide samples of his DNA to prove he's actually a carbon-based life form. Show us your hairline, you clueless carnival barker. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Reminds me of two very funny words, Orly Tates. Hey, thanks for listening. Send me an email, Peter at peterbcollins.com. See what happens.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.